Welcome to the new neighborhood. We are excited to highlight innovative early childhood work taking place in communities across the country.
In each episode, we'll be talking to people who are building a new sense of community, supporting young children and their families, and focusing on equity right from the start to create a generation where all children and their families thrive. I'm Kaylin O'Connor.
And I'm Sanaa Sharif, and we are your co-hosts for the new neighborhood.
Did you know that there are reparations committees around the nation working on restorative justice? I also learned that tenants are being evicted by text and they have a right to an evictions process,
which may give them some additional time before they end up being homeless and allow them chances to find resources. Tenant Leadership Academy talked about tenants' rights, navigating resources, financial literacy, and even ways to improve conditions in the community. And I think that is so awesome. So I'm really glad that we're digging into issues around housing and eviction with our guests today.
Linda King and Ari Wibbold are joining us from United Way of the Columbia Willamette to talk about their work in Multnomah County and Portland, Oregon. Linda and Ari, can you introduce yourselves?
Hello, my name is Linda King. I'm the Director of Housing Stability with United Way of the Columbia Willamette.
Hi, I'm Ari Wibbold. I'm the Housing Programs Manager with United Way of the Columbia Willamette.
Welcome. We'd like to start by giving our listeners a sense of what's been going on with housing and specifically evictions since this COVID pandemic began. So Linda, can you tell us about that landscape?
I can. Thank you, Sanaa. I'm a little bit hesitant to take you all the way back to the pandemic, but this is a really historic time, especially for in the sense of tenant protections. This is the first time that evictions and tenant protections have ever had the notoriety that they've had before. And part of it is in due because of what occurred during the pandemic. I'll take you back just a little bit to pre-pandemic, at least in Portland, Oregon, and I'm sure across the nation. We were recognizing that evictions, because of high rents, increased costs and such, were looming. Prior to the pandemic, they were at not near record levels across the United States and in Portland, but pretty close to it. And then when the pandemic struck, of course, folks weren't able to work. Folks were, you know, getting sick. Our whole landscape changed. Many renters were not in a position to pay rent, and everything went into chaos. Many cities and states provided access to rental assistance, but not near enough with what was needed. And I think in many cases, the amounts of funds that were provided were grossly underestimated. And so folks at the higher levels believed that there was enough resource available to tenants to be able to make landlords whole by getting funds to the tenants to pay their rent. But what we recognized is that it wasn't just that tenants weren't unable to pay rent. We had some landlords that found this really unique environment an opportunity to increase their wealth and to become whole in other ways. And so we started to see increases in evictions occur. And probably midway through the pandemic, we started to recognize that the numbers of evictions rose from maybe 1,500 a month to 2,000 a week. And we were preparing for what folks were considering or calling an eviction avalanche. And that occurred because the rent assistance, at least in Oregon, the rent assistance program that was made available throughout the state had its own problems with delivering and making access to rent assistance funds available for folks in the community. And so there were lots of backlog. There was systems that were shutting down. There were duplicate payments that were being made. It just became chaotic. And so that process caused problems for renters to access resource. And then as the resources began to wane and run out, the evictions continued to rise. And so what we were seeing really was just a panic in our state. We were already at that time having problems and concerns with homelessness. And we started to see the direct impact that evictions had on what I call the pipeline into homelessness. Literally evictions, folks falling into eviction, and then falling right from eviction into homelessness, and in some cases, right onto the street. So literally, we saw during that time of the pandemic, the impact of evictions affecting folks directly and causing them to become homeless and on the streets.
Can you talk about income requirements, deposits, and other unfair practices that make it hard to find and keep housing?
I can. Thank you. Again, I mentioned earlier the difficulty that folks are having with the increase in rents. In Oregon, we saw rents increase at a rate of 10% a year. This is pre-pandemic and during the pandemic. Most folks that our program serves are what we consider low and extremely low income. So these are individuals that make 60% of the area median income. And most of those individuals who are in that income bracket struggle with being able to make monthly rents. And many of those folks are paying in excess of 50% of their income going towards rent. And what's considered affordable is 30% of your income going towards rent. So if you could imagine an increase of having to pay 50% of your income towards rent and then whatever remaining towards utilities and food and, you know, whatever other expenses there are in the household, there just isn't enough money. So folks are trapped in situations where they're not able to move. There's a lack of affordable housing. And so even if they had the ability to locate a place that was more affordable, then there are the barriers of security deposits. And in many cases, until recent rules were put in place, landlords could ask for 2 times the rent plus 1 month in security deposits or move-in costs. Also, landlords are asking for things like renter's insurance. And if you're low income, there are protections that help prevent folks from having to pay things like renter's insurance, but there are no protections for the amount of move-in costs that a landlord can pay until recently. So we have situations where housing has become unaffordable for most people, definitely unaffordable for folks who are between 60 and 80% of the area median income. And those are our most vulnerable populations. So those are the folks that are on the margins that are struggling, you know, month to month with making ends meet. This is a very difficult time for them because of the increased rents and costs.
Thanks, Linda. Can you talk about what the experience of eviction is like for families? And what tools do people normally have to stay in their homes?
Well, if you can imagine, the experience is extremely traumatic. You know, most folks, again, recognize long before the eviction that it's becoming really difficult to pay rent. And so long before they're unable to pay rent, most often folks are making plans for what to do, like where to go. They've exhausted all of their resources. They've contacted community-based organizations that might be providing rent assistance. They've contacted friends, you know, family, landlords to try to work things out. And so there's an undue amount of stress going into the evictions process. And because the evictions process happens very quickly, it's really difficult to get your feet underneath you once you slip past that late fee or the late date of paying rent. It becomes very traumatic because in many cases, landlords are already, they have the resource to make plans to evict an individual. And if someone at any point contacts their landlord and expresses their inability to pay, the landlord has the resource to start the preparation process of moving towards evictions. Until recently, the eviction process, as I said, moved very, very quickly, and folks had just a matter of days and in some cases up to a week before they had to appear in court to fight for eviction. Recently, again, there have been laws and they differ from state to state, but in Oregon, there are laws that have been implemented that help slow that evictions process down to give folks an opportunity to connect with the resources that are in the community that may help by providing rent assistance. And that will provide legal defense for them. And what we know is that for every individual that enters a court case with an attorney, it increases their ability to work through that eviction 4 times more likely to end in a resolvable case or in a situation where they don't have to vacate their homes. But not very many people know that. And so there have been lots of, at least in Oregon, efforts made to provide information and to protect tenants from having to leave their homes, to be displaced from their homes, and for vacating.
If I could add to that, from my experience speaking with those clients of the program, one of the most common things that I hear is just they have very low understanding of how the process works and what their rights are. But also, you know, I'll get questions like, should I show up to court? Should I be there? So kind of like, you know, a lack of sort of basic understanding of how to put their best foot forward, legally speaking. So I think that's one of the great values of this program, is connecting folks to legal assistance, because like Linda said, the eviction process is complicated. And for somebody who's never been in it before, and a lot of people that we're serving, this is their first time going through it. Sometimes it's easier just not to show up at all or to vacate. So that legal aspect is huge.
Thank you for adding that piece, Ari. I certainly can say that I do know what that experience is like. It's very harrowing. And after going through the Tenant Leadership Academy, I've learned about unfair practices such as holding tenants responsible for the property outside of the apartment, such as the sidewalk and things that the landlord is responsible for, but still violating the tenant because of it. In addition, as I mentioned before, some people have been evicted by text. And there's a specific case here in Guilford County where an individual received the text, and by the end of the week, her things were on the curb. Well, she never had a court date. She never had a hearing. She never received a notice or anything. So that's 100% illegal. I did learn that both Legal Aid and the Greensboro Housing Coalition are also partnering with families and people in the community to help prevent these types of unfair practices. So I'm glad to hear that your United Way is making a really critical investment related to housing. Ari, can you describe the eviction prevention program and how it works?
Sure. It is run by the Portland Housing Bureau and is a collaboration between our United Way of the Columbia Willamette, Metropolitan Public Defender, PCC, that's Portland Community College's Clear Clinic, Oregon Law Center. Those are the legal partners in the program. It's free legal support for low-income tenants that are facing eviction. So those folks, to be eligible, must have a termination notice or an eviction case. We are serving a particular part of our community. So folks, to be eligible, have to live in the city of Portland, have to meet the income requirements. And we have a sort of a special focus on serving BIPOC renters. And part of that, you know, we're doing some outreach specifically in BIPOC communities to make sure that we're reaching those that are most impacted by the housing crisis. And we've seen some really good and promising results there. The role that we play, United Way, is, you know, we help distribute funds to landlords and provide rent assistance to clients to pay for all sorts of things to keep people housed. So that could include their arrears or, you know, their past due rent, utilities, late fees, sort of select damages, and a limited amount of future rent assistance to allow for future stability as well. And also we can help with some transitional assistance. So if folks are moving out of their unit and have secured a new one that is stable and to their liking, we can help them with the move. We can help them with security deposits. In some instances, we can even help with the, you know, putting their stuff in storage or that sort of thing. Oh, it's a lot of different services to make sure that the move is as pain-free as possible. Because like we've talked about, this can be such a traumatic experience for somebody to move or to be at threat of eviction. So those are kind of the services that we provide. And the way that we work, we're a fairly small team. It's just, you know, Linda and I and one other person. And so, you know, we call ourselves sort of the small but mighty housing team at United Way of the Columbia Willamette. But I think what makes us impactful is sort of the ability to move quickly and to move nimbly. Some of the sort of larger rent assistance agencies can take weeks to get payments out the door. And sometimes that's just frankly too late to make a difference. Whereas we can, you know, turn around a payment within a matter of days. And in some instances, you know, we can deliver a check directly to court so that it's there at the start of trial, which we found for a lot of landlords to be a really pleasant surprise and has kind of led to us being able to build some really positive relationships based on trust with landlords and with our partners and with tenants in the community.
Great. Thanks, Ari. I'm curious, for a typical eviction case, how much money and how much of a lawyer's time is required to help stabilize someone's housing?
Sure. So there are, you know, obviously ranges to this. And we found that the average amount of assistance needed to resolve an eviction has actually decreased since the beginning of the program. But we find that it's roughly about $4,000 to $5,000 per household. And I checked in with our legal partners on that question of how long it takes on the legal side of things, because Linda and I are not attorneys. And they said, you know, that again, it's a range, and that's strongly impacted by whether a case goes to trial. But they said that the fastest they can resolve a very simple case is 2 hours. And the more complex cases, the ones that have extensive negotiations and have to go to trial, can be upwards of 40, 50 hours of work. But overall, because so many cases are for non-payment, as Linda mentioned previously, and can be resolved with negotiation and then arranging a payment plan, that the overall average is about 4 to 6 hours per case. And Linda, you might have something you want to add there.
Thank you, Ari. I think what I'd like to add is, you know, when you think about the numbers, the amount that evictions cost, the average that we're seeing right now, as Ari said, is between $4,000 and $5,000, which is about the equivalent to, you know, 1 month's, maybe 2 months worth of rent. We're not seeing very many landlords who are allowing their tenants to accumulate, you know, multiple months of unpaid rent. It's usually an eviction after that first month's rent. And then if you take a look at the average number of hours that it takes to solve an eviction, it amazes me the impact that it has. Such a low number, $5,000, 4 to 5 hours worth of work, can literally devastate the life of the tenant who is displaced, ends up with an eviction on their record for often 5 years, is prevented from accessing housing for those 5 years, or is at least struggling to get into housing for those 5 years, more than likely lack the resource to regain housing. So it makes sense, just on those numbers alone and just with that data alone, for all of us to invest in preventing evictions. Evictions is one of the quickest ways that we're seeing families ending up in homeless or ending up homelessness. And so with a very little amount of money, with a very small investment of time, we can prevent folks from ending up in eviction, and we can prevent people from experiencing long-term housing instability. And so our role at United Way is to bring that information, or one of our roles is to bring that information forward to our legislation and help people understand the small investment that it takes to end or prevent or minimize one area of homelessness from accumulating, and think about investing resources and funds and support in eviction prevention programs. It used to be that eviction prevention programs were not thought to be very helpful, and so rent assistance was needed. We now know that eviction prevention is absolutely necessary, especially with the increase of rent. And without eviction prevention programs, our homelessness population will grow rapidly across the nation. So that's what I'd like to add, is just really focusing on the need to address this hugely impactful and terribly traumatic experience with so little resource, that we really should think about investing more.
Right. I'm just really struck by those numbers. To the family that's struggling to pay their rent, those numbers are huge and insurmountable. But from an investment perspective of funders or government, mm-hmm. those are small amounts to stabilize families. And I know you serve tenants of all ages and family types, but this podcast, we focus on early childhood. And I just think about how important that stability is in early childhood, and how much the stress on parents and the stress on children themselves has a long-term impact that it's hard to put a dollar amount on. So those investments are just so critical.
Thank you for bringing that to light, that, you know, what we're also talking about. Yes, we do serve everyone that is, or anyone that's experiencing an eviction. Our program doesn't, and on purpose, really focus on collecting data around whether or not there are children in the household. Because what we want to do is to make sure that all households, not just households with children, but all households have equitable access to resources that can help keep them housed. But from the information that we learned from families that are impacted by this, it is huge. And the stress of the parents with what to do with their children, you know, imagine the thought of having to worry about where you're going to sleep the next night, and having a child that you also have to worry about how you're going to get them to the school the next night, not knowing where you're going to stay. Really quickly, I had a situation occur with this work, and it was just kind of cemented for me exactly why I do this. I was on my way to the office one day, and I turned the corner and I saw all of this, you know, furniture and belongings out on the street. And I was thinking to myself, you know, where's the truck? Like, where's the the moving truck, why would you just sit your stuff out on the street? And then when I turned, I could see that there was a sheriff's car sitting there. So I knew immediately what it was. It was a mom with three children that were literally being evicted from her home. And of course, I made the U-turn in the street, brought the car, you know, went up and had a conversation. But it struck me that even though I was providing information that would have provided access to resources, the impact of having your belongings set on the street with your children present was so shocking and so traumatic that the person didn't even hear what I was saying. I could tell that she was not registering. So if it's difficult for the parents to imagine this, imagine the impact and the effect that it has on our children, which is, again, why this work is so very important and why resources need to be invested to prevent evictions.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. And Kaylin, I appreciate you bringing up the early childhood aspect and the trauma that can come from this experience in early childhood. There were two things that was said. Ari, you mentioned the checks being presented in the courtroom. I can only imagine what that does for families who really may feel like there's no hope or really don't understand that there's a pathway. And for a lot of families, there isn't a pathway. And Linda, you mentioned impact. So based on what you've been tracking, what can you say about the impact of this work?
Sure. So we, you know, we keep data on the, you know, the clients that we've served, and we sort of track the you know, the extent of our impact numerically, but also, you know, we are in contact with some of the clients and we hear their stories as humans as well. And so I think from a sort of data standpoint, we know that we have served over 800 households. The most recent number was 823, but that should have climbed by now. 43% of those being BIPOC households. I talked briefly earlier about bringing on a new outreach coordinator who has done really amazing work in an area of Portland, East Portland, that has some traditional BIPOC communities. And we've seen our numbers increase there in terms of bringing Black and African-American families into the program. And that's something that we've been very strategic about. And we're really happy to see the progress made that we have. So yeah, you know, over 800 families or households served, and that includes, you know, the financial assistance, but also the legal assistance aspect as well. So we know that, you know, more than 2.5 million has been committed in funding at this point, and that number is going to grow. So those are sort of the overall numbers, but just talking about sort of the human impact in speaking with the clients of this program, a lot of them have been burned in the past trying to seek assistance and been unable to do so and made promises that weren't delivered. And so, you know, one thing that we hear is just relief that we have kept our word. And so that's something that has been sort of an eye-opener for me of just, you know, you assume these programs are there as sort of a bedrock, but a lot of folks have a lot of distrust that they're going to come to their aid. So one thing we try to be is incredibly responsive and make sure that no one we're serving is falling through the cracks. So there's the human aspect as well as the numbers.
Yes, thank you for that, Ari. The other thing that I'd like to mention that I think is hugely important and has had a tremendous impact on the clients that we serve, and that's that we have intentionally made this a very low barrier program. And what that means is that we have minimized the barriers that normal rent assistance and public service programs create for people. We collect the basic information that we need to determine eligibility. And once the eligibility is determined, which again is very basic, we put some of the onus of proving that eligibility on the landlords by requesting ledgers that verify what's owed, and that also commit to ensuring that the landlords are going to apply the funds that are being accessed directly to the benefit of the tenant, not necessarily to the benefit of the landlord, which is why there's a lot of negotiation that happens to eliminate and minimize some of the erroneous late fees and other charges that occur that tenants on their own would struggle to pay if they had the resources to do so. And so we try to eliminate those barriers so that, number one, it increases the likelihood of a positive outcome, and so that it decreases the amount of time that it would take for us to process payments and get them out the door and get the evictions resolved and addressed. And I know that in other situations, other programs, low barrier access to resources is an area that people struggle with providing. I'm not sure why, because there are ways of making low barrier or access to low barrier programs very effective, as we've proven to do. But I think that that's one of the reasons that the impact is so great for the clients as well, because it's not just that they received services that helped preserve their housing. It's also that they received services that were very easy to access to help preserve their housing. And so there wasn't a lot of stress, a lot of strain. I mean, the moment that a client has been determined eligible, which we provide in a matter of hours, and at the most a day, I don't think we've gone past a day with determining eligibility, we ensure that that client knows, or that tenant knows, that there's not much more that they need to worry about from that point on, because we're going to ensure that what it takes to resolve or cure that eviction happens. And again, in most cases, when funding is available, as Ari mentioned, we will try to provide additional rent assistance to help keep that family secure for as long as we possibly can. Right now, funds are only available to allow us to help them remain secure for a month. But in past months, it's been multiple months if that's been what's needed. But again, that's the impact that we know creates that sense of relief for families, because we hear it. We receive letters, we receive emails, we receive phone calls, we receive messages from the attorneys, from clients who are expressing that sense of gratitude and that sense of relief. So we know that this is working across the board. And we hear it from landlords as well. We hear also landlords who are very, very thankful, landlords who are relieved to know that they haven't had to evict a family or evict an individual or a longstanding tenant of theirs. So the gratitude is extended literally across the board between the clients and the landlords in many cases.
I wish this kind of support was available for families everywhere. Do you know of other United Ways or other organizations that have similar programs around the country? And if not, or assuming that's not everywhere, which we know it's not, what can our listeners do to advocate for programs like this in their communities?
Yes, there are very small eviction legal defense programs located in places like Los Angeles, Long Beach, New York, like Colorado, and they're spread out across the country. However, all states have a housing bureau or housing authority that has the ability to start those legal defense programs. Our Portland Housing Bureau is reaching out and has been contacted by many housing bureaus across the United States wanting to know a little bit more about this eviction prevention program and to learn how to implement the same processes and policies that we're using here. And so what I would say to do, the way to advocate really is to contact your housing authorities, to contact your housing bureaus, talk with your legal aid services. This isn't a program that is unknown to most of those folks. Most of those folks are aware of eviction legal defense and of eviction prevention. I think what they struggle with is finding funders and stakeholders that are willing to invest in creating the resource. And that, you know, comes from advocacy. It comes from advocacy at the state level, the local level, legislative level. And I think for tenants, for tenant advocates, that's the place to start, to advocate for this level of resource. And then, of course, if folks are interested, then please feel free to reach out to either Ari or myself at the United Way of the Columbia Willamette.
And also for folks locally that are looking for assistance, they can reach out to us, or they can also look at the Eviction Legal Defense Program's website. And there's information there on how to go through the intake process, because we want to make sure for folks who are listening that are in need of rent assistance in our area, they know where to go. So check out the program's webpage.
Thank you, Ari. I just want to touch really quickly on something you mentioned earlier, Linda, about the erroneous charges, late fees, et cetera. And I just want to encourage any listener, I advocate for families daily. I encourage you to get your rent ledgers and review them with a fine-tooth comb and make sure there's nothing there that does not belong there. Before we close out, I would love to hear a little bit more about the Black Indigenous People of Color, or BIPOC, home ownership initiative that you mentioned, Linda. So can you just tell us what you're doing with that?
I can. Thank you, Sanaa, for asking about that. This is a project, a pilot project that we are in the process of trying to put together that includes a group of individuals who work directly and specifically with in-home childcare providers, which is a rapidly evaporating resource in the communities across the United States. BIPOC home ownership is an area that I think, you know, a great many of folks want to see increase and know needs to increase, but it's just wrought with barriers from start to finish. And so this particular program and collaboration is working with a group of credit unions and in-home childcare provider resources and financial literacy individuals and groups of folks who provide microloans. And what we're trying to do is to identify all of the barriers to home ownership and then match those barriers with resource by putting together a pilot project that from start to finish helps prepare individuals who are interested in home ownership from literally start to finish. So we have, you know, credit unions who are on board with helping folks understand, you know, basic financial literacy, that understand the difference between a bank and a credit union, the difference between a savings account and understanding your credit and repairing your credit, and, you know, mortgages and just the whole gamut of the financial aspect of homeownership that's involved. And they're providing that level of support, not necessarily for any length of time, but as individuals need it. So it's a self-paced project. People can start and work at their own pace. It may take an individual 6 months to get through the financial literacy piece. It may take them 2 years, and it's completely okay in whatever fashion they need to approach it. And then next is really providing them with support and education around the loan process and loan acquisition. And so we have folks that are in the real estate area that are wanting to put together that level of education and information, and then connect folks to a real estate agent and connect folks to the support around identifying a lender and then identifying a house. And so it's the entire process from start to finish where individuals will have access to a mentor that will walk them through the entire process of home ownership and home ownership education, and then provide them with long-term support to remain in their homes. Now, as you can imagine, this is a huge undertaking, and it isn't a new idea. There are many home ownership programs across the United States and probably in every state. But I think what makes this particular program unique is all of the different individuals that are coming together to ensure that the right amount of resource is provided so that, again, we make this process as painless as possible, but also as informative as possible. And so what that will look like moving forward, we're not quite sure, because again, this is a pilot project. It really does depend. We're trying to adjust to what's happening in the marketplace, but then also keep folks moving forward. We're looking at other areas of investment, not only through traditional home ownership, but real estate trust investment. We're looking at, there are groups of individuals and funders that are wanting, and investors who are wanting to invest specifically in ensuring that they purchase properties that would be specifically for a group of individuals. So in this case, it's in-home childcare providers, and then allow them access to those properties where that individual is providing and paying a mortgage per se, or portion of their payment goes towards mortgage. And at a certain point during their tenancy, they're able to access and begin to acquire equity. So it's a little bit of a complicated process that we're looking into and learning a little bit more about, so that we can open up the avenues that will allow folks to have greater access to home ownership. So it sounds like a lot, because it is a lot. And it sounds maybe nonspecific, because we're trying to move this forward and adjust to the changing needs of the market, but still increasing the number of Black and Indigenous and other people of color who are accessing home ownership.
Thanks, Linda. And thank you both for sharing about the housing stability programs that you're working on. We have a final question we always like to ask all our guests. In the past, it was what you think the secret sauce is to making a community a great place to raise a child. This season, we're asking about the secret sauce or a special ingredient. So what do you think it is? What makes a community a great place to raise a child?
I'll go first on this one. This is what I'm living right now. I have a preschooler at home and twin 4-month-olds. So I'm always looking for free fun. I think that's a big part of what makes a community a great place to raise a child. And, you know, one thing that I would shout out is just the value of good, well-funded local libraries. Our local branch right now is shut down for repairs for another month or so. And we have felt the impact of that in terms of, you know, the story times that we go to with our kiddos are not available. Those are places where people go to access services and go to use free internet and learn about what's out there to help them and maybe get access to a program like the Eviction Legal Defense Program. So I would say strong, well-funded local libraries with plenty of free fun is my secret sauce.
And I would piggyback and say yes to everything that Ari just said, but I would also say that the secret sauce, at least for me and my experience, has been a community where there are many, 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 many villages, small villages, where people are connected with one another and are resourced well enough to provide different levels of support for one another. I think that's what's lacking, is that sense of community and that sense of belonging. And so we have folks that are trying to make it alone and believing that they're the only ones in the fight, or that there's, you know, nobody else out there experiencing what they're experiencing. And so I think increasing that sense of community strengthens the family network all the way around. And those tiny villages help lend resource where your home may not have the resource, but another home within your village may. And because it is a village, everyone is sharing together. So that's what I think the secret sauce is. I'd love to see more of that tiny village network happening within our own community. Yeah, so that's the secret sauce for me.
I love both of those answers. Thank you. Many thanks to Ari and Linda for joining us today. And to our listeners, we'd love to hear from you about what you're involved in that's making your community a better place for kids and families. We have a link in the show notes to a form you can fill out to tell us about your work, and we might follow up with you to feature it in a podcast, in a newsletter, or on the New Neighborhood Hub on our website.
Yeah, so make sure you write us. We'd love to see it. Thank you for listening to The New Neighborhood. Be sure to check the show notes for links and additional information about some of the things we talked about today. And please join us next time for more insights into how communities are coming together to create new neighborhoods and support early learning and development. This limited series podcast is a production of the Center for the Study of Social Policy. For more information or to contact us, visit us online at www.csSP.org.